Welcome to episode 9 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and Justice Department, now a partner in our New York office. Jason Weinstein, who was formerly with the Justice Department, overseeing criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. A little later in our program, we're pleased to be able to talk to Adam Sedgwick, the Senior Information Technology Policy Advisor at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who'll be talking to us about the cybersecurity framework. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with NSA, DHS, and holding the record for returning to Steptoe & Johnson the most times in a career. Let's get started with our overview of the week in news. And as always these days, we'll begin with this week in NSA. There's a lot to talk about there. Most importantly, probably, NSA is weighing options for revising the 215 telephone metadata program. Their options have leaked, and the fact that they presented those options to the president ahead of schedule, it was supposed to be the end of March, but they got them in at the beginning of March, maybe because there were no good options. So delivering bad options, you might as well be early. The options that they're considering are basically responding to the president's discomfort with the idea that all this data is scooped up and stored at NSA, where people feel that they can't tell what's happening to it. And so the president said, well, what can we do to ease that concern? And the agencies appear to be coming back. It's not really just NSA, saying, well, you could leave it at NSA, but obviously you don't like that. So you could give it to some other agency, the FBI, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or you could leave it in the hands of the carriers, or perhaps you could find some trusted third party, you know, the Presbyterian Church, somebody who would be willing to hold on to it and only let the government have access in response to a special query based on reasonable, articulable suspicion. This is an interesting problem because most of the legal innovation associated with this program is the idea that the government is going to collect and store the data without looking at it before it actually has a particular person to search for, on the theory that if it didn't do that when it had somebody to search for, it wouldn't have any data because the phone companies would no longer have it available in a format that would allow an easy search. So putting into third-party hands, leaving it with the carriers has some appeal because it eliminates not the broad hostility to NSA, but at least the legal objections. But the government is running into problems in that other government agencies don't have any significantly more trust than NSA is facing, and certainly wouldn't once they started holding the data. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court probably won't, and in my view, shouldn't take this data. And the carriers haven't the slightest interest in becoming frontline participants in this mass culture war over NSA. So the agencies have reported. It's not clear where this is going to go. Stay tuned. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence also put out something saying to the world, if you've got an idea for technology that might get us out of this bind, please give us your ideas. And something like 24 companies provided ideas. They were promised confidentiality. Of course, the privacy groups immediately tried to FOIA the details and are planning to litigate to find out who has the nerve to actually offer to help the U.S. government deal with its serious national security concerns. That's not all that's happening in NSA. There was another Snowden story, this time involving sex, sort of. The British, unlikely though that may seem. Michael, what was that story?
Yeah, this is a twofer. It's part of this week in NSA and also this week in salacious internet news stories. This one now is a report that the UK's equivalent of NSA, GCHQ, intercepted and stored Yahoo webcam images from millions of Yahoo users. Apparently, the program is called Optic Nerve, and it's unclear exactly what sorts of people were being surveilled. There are claims that this was bulk surveillance, but it also appears that some of the collection was done as a test bed, some of the collection was done just of metadata, and then some collection was done of innocent users. But, you know, right now, until there's more reporting, it's very difficult to say what was what. And it's also unclear what involvement, if any, NSA had in this, other than to provide some of the technology to GCHQ. But there are some interesting details about this. Apparently, there was so much data that could be collected that GCHQ limited themselves to just taking a snapshot every 5 minutes of whatever images were being collected. The other thing that was quite amusing is that apparently there was just a lot of nudity in the images. They estimated somewhere between 3% and 11% of the Yahoo webcam imagery that was harvested by GCHQ contained, quote, undesirable nudity, as opposed to desirable nudity.
I can certainly imagine what the difference would be.
You know, in case people fear that GCHQ wasn't concerned about people's rights and sensitivities, they actually alerted their own employees that some of these images might be disturbing, and if they didn't want to be confronted with disturbing imagery, they shouldn't open the files. So I suspect we'll learn more about this as the days progress. Right now, it's still a little bit unclear exactly what was collected.
You know, it reminds me of my time talking to and advising the folks who were looking for child porn at a big ISP, and some of the people who did that had to look at the images all day to decide whether it was child porn. And one of the things that they started doing was taking big yellow stickies and putting it right in the middle of the screen, which guaranteed that they didn't see the worst of it, but you could usually tell exactly what was going on. And it was a way of avoiding the kind of constant eroding of your sense of what right and wrong by looking at this stuff. So maybe that's what the GCHQ guys and women are doing. This is you know, every 5 minutes, you know, you could miss the whole thing if you only do it every 5 minutes. The Canadians are getting into this. It's like English speaking spasms of concern. The Canadians have started raising concerns about NSA in the context of extradition, and I'm not sure I quite understood what the legal issue here is, but I'm confident that Jason does.
Well, I'm not so confident, but I'll try anyway. And but for the story that Michael just did, this would have probably been the strangest NSA related story of the week. So there's a case pending in British Columbia in which the U.S. is seeking extradition from Canada of certain suspects in a drug case. And having already apparently thrown in the kitchen sink, defense counsel decided to submit an application seeking disclosure of information on the extent to which the U.S. engaged directly or indirectly in surveillance of communications or other activities of Canadian judges and lawyers and notaries and paralegals. And the motion asked that the Canadian officials the Canadian government requests information from the U.S. on whether the NSA engaged in any surveillance of Canadian judicial officials and whether Canadian intelligence services have information about that. Over the objection of the Canadian prosecutors, the Supreme Court of British Columbia ordered a hearing on the motion. The prosecutors pointed out that the court had no jurisdiction to order the NSA or the U.S. government to do anything and that the information being sought was completely irrelevant to the drug case and the matter of an extradition and drug case. The court gave
them. They're judges and they're interested, right?
Well, that was not far off from the actual answer. The court acknowledged that at least that it couldn't order the U.S. to disclose anything, but said it could order the Canadian government to disclose what it knew. And the court said it was too early to conclude that the information was irrelevant until after it saw the irrelevant information. And then it could decide that it was irrelevant. What makes the case interesting is that while there are plenty of other countries, from other parts of the English-speaking world who have made a lot of noise, about how the NSA leaks may affect, various aspects of the U.S. relationship with those countries, including the viability of systems for sharing information, here you have issues relating to NSA surveillance being used to interfere with a foreign judicial proceeding that the U.S. has an interest in. So now it's making its way into foreign courtrooms as well. And in some ways, it echoes what we're starting to see on the U.S. side of the border, too. We previously discussed some of the cases, including a robbery case in South Florida, where defense lawyers are trying to exploit the Snowden leaks and the information about the NSA to try to gain traction and to make things more difficult for the prosecution, even in domestic criminal cases. So it's a little disturbing that we're now seeing that overseas as well.
Yeah. Well, not just overseas. Jim Silkinet, the ABA president, weighed in with a letter to NSA objecting to, or at least asking some very pointed questions about NSA's practices with respect to client confidences. Did you take a look at that?
Yeah, we had talked last week about the fact that there were reports that Australian intelligence had apparently reportedly intercepted communications between lawyers at the law firm Mayer Brown and the government of Indonesia, which was their client, relating to advice Mayer Brown was giving in a trade dispute with the U.S. And apparently the Australians notified the NSA that they were monitoring those communications in the NSA General Counsel's office. Reportedly provided guidance about how to do that in a way that was in compliance with the law. And as you said, last week, the head of the ABA sent a letter to General Alexander asking information about the NSA's policies and practices, because keep in mind, this was interception that was done by the Australians, although you wouldn't know it from most of the press coverage of it, but asking what the NSA's own policies and practices were regarding surveillance of attorney-client communications and whether those policies and practices were followed in this case. As we've talked about before, I suspect that most lawyers who work with foreign clients, including the lawyers who represented the government of Indonesia here, were acutely aware of the risk that their international communications were going to be or subject to being spied on by foreign governments. And so I doubt this is as much of a surprise to the actual lawyers involved as it apparently is to the ABA. Interestingly, in a related story, we talked last week about the fact that this flap over Mayer Brown was being cited in the effort by the Center for Constitutional Rights to revive its lawsuit over the terrorist surveillance program, which was discontinued back in 2007. And the Center for Constitutional Rights filed suit back in 2006, challenging the warrantless wiretapping program and arguing that there was a high probability that their communications with their clients, who I think were largely in Guantanamo, had been unlawfully and unconstitutionally surveilled by the NSA and were being stored by the government. The district court threw the case out, finding that whatever efforts the organization lawyers had to go to avoid government surveillance, like actually meeting with their clients in person, was not enough to show an injury and an interference with their ability to do their job. The Ninth Circuit agreed, citing the Clapper case, and in light of the Snowden leaks and this more recently this Mayer Brown flap, the organization was trying to get the Supreme Court to review the case, and just yesterday the Supreme Court refused. So perhaps this is the end of that piece of litigation, but we always have Larry Klayman.
Oh God, yes, we will always have Larry Klayman. That's a saying to live by. Yes.
But before we leave NSA and Snowden, I would just observe that I would think there are probably some people in the White House and State Department right now who really wish we were tapping Angela Merkel's cell phone. Since what Germany does with regard to Russia's invasion of Ukraine is going to be pretty critical to whether we impose.
Yeah, they've already actually said, contrary to the U.S. Position, that there's no way they're going to kick them out of the G8 because it's an opportunity to talk, and who can be against an opportunity to talk? Yeah, well, this confirms my position on spying on Angela Merkel, that Germany is a great ally 85% of the time, and Chris Smith loves Rihanna 85% of the time, but it's the other 15 you really need to get the intelligence on. I have to say, Jim Silkinet's letter kind of galled me because I worked on an ABA project and a resolution that was a response to widespread knowledge that the Chinese have hacked most of the AMLA 100. Going right through the process of getting approval for a resolution that said we don't like this and getting it approved, and yet nobody at the ABA sent the Prime Minister of China a letter, anything like what Silkenet sent to NSA, even though they were fully authorized, and as far as I can tell, Silkenet was not the slightest bit authorized to take action by the ABA as a body. It's like the ABA just is determined to blame America first or something. But I won't ask you to comment on that. Let's instead move on to LabMD and their FTC case, which continues to completely come apart as far as I can tell. We talked about this last week. Is there anything new in the collapse of LabMD's claims?
Well, there is a little bit, and it's interesting because a lot of private companies have put tremendous amount of hope into the LabMD and Wyndham Hotels' challenges to the FTC's authority to basically regulate private companies' data security practices. And it does seem that LabMD, at least for the moment, has given up the ghost. First, the FTC essentially rejected LabMD's claim that the FTC had no such authority. This was during the FTC's own administrative process. At the same time, LabMD had gone to the 11th Circuit before the FTC was even done with its internal process and sought review by the 11th Circuit of what LabMD expected the FTC's outcome to be. And the 11th Circuit said it's premature, kicked it out. And then to top it all off, LabMD voluntarily withdrew a suit that it had filed in federal court in Washington, D.C., saying it was for procedural reasons, but it's unclear what those reasons might be. So, you know, it's interesting because the lawyers representing LabMD are basically a group of activist lawyers who are opposed to government authority of all sorts of sorts. So they may just have run out of money. I'm speculating there, but it does seem in the end that this challenge isn't going to amount to much. You know, I think we may have discussed before that the Wyndham Hotels challenge is not likely to get very far in the district court. Discovery is proceeding. The judge still hasn't ruled on Wyndham Hotels' motion to dismiss the FTC complaint. But it does appear likely that she will do so at some point. So for the foreseeable future, the FTC is going to be the 800-pound gorilla when it comes to regulation of companies' data.
Well, if we can take a moment for a book review, I actually read the book written by the CEO of LabMD about the FTC proceedings called The Devil Inside the Beltway, the devil being the FTC. And it's self-published, I'm pretty sure, and self-written clearly. But a kind of a guilty pleasure, right? Because he talks very candidly. I think he's made some mistakes, but he talks candidly about the privacy bar in Washington and his unhappiness with them when they tell him, "Look, this'll bankrupt you if you try to fight it. Just sign up to the consent decree." And his resistance to that idea. He suffered, the problem he had was simply that old LimeWire thing where you share your music and you collect everybody else's shared music, and if you're not careful, you end up sharing all the documents on your network. That's what happened to him, and some researcher found his documents offered for sharing, sent him a letter saying, "I got these documents off of your system using LimeWire. Would you like to hire me to tell you how to avoid this?" He got mad. He thought he was being extorted. And the next thing he knew, the contractor, the security consultant had used him as an example in congressional testimony of bad security practices, which brought the FTC down on his head. He thought that he was being extorted by the government, by this guy, that they were all in cahoots, that the devil was on all sides of him. And that's how he developed this, you know, chip on his shoulder for the FTC. And, you know, he's a difficult guy. He's probably wrong about some of this stuff. But, you know, the penalty for being wrong and for being a difficult guy really probably shouldn't be bankruptcy and no opportunity to be heard on your fundamental claim. But that seems to be where he's ended up.
Well, I mean, the FTC, whatever the merits of this case, the FTC has an enormous amount of leverage, and not just in these data privacy cases, but in false advertising cases and lots of other consumer protection claims they bring. And that's why very few companies ever really contest the FTC enforcement actions and
The advice he got from all those Washington lawyers that he hated was the right advice. You know, he just wasn't prepared to take it because he had an attitude. It's not just in high school that having a bad attitude will get you in deep trouble. Well, the other thing that I thought was interesting was we actually had progress on a kind of copyright issue in Washington. House voted to let us buy and unlock cell phones. Jason, you were in charge of intellectual property enforcement at the Justice Department. And 5 years ago, it was inconceivable that the House of Representatives would vote to say, you know, there's just too much copyright protection. Is this a sign that, you know, maybe we've kind of come to the high tide mark, for copyright enforcement?
No, first of all, I had nothing to do with this, I should say, the cell phone unlocking issue. But I think it's more a recognition of the fact that the issue of whether or not you can unlock your cell phones has very little to do with copyright. You know, this is a very strange intersection of a copyright-related statute and, you know, competition and consumer freedom. Last week, the House passed a bill that would permit cell phone users to unlock their phones and bring them to another carrier without the existing, the first carrier's permission. And the bill, which Congressman Goodlatte introduced, would overturn a decision by the Librarian of Congress that made unlocking cell phones without a carrier's permission a violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That law, which dates back to 1998, has among its features a provision that prohibits circumvention of technical measures that are meant to protect copyrighted works. Digital rights management software, the kind of thing that prevents you from copying and pirating digital content on DVDs.
And apparently is going to prevent me from using Kruger coffee machines without an approved cup.
Right. That's right. It's a broadly worded provision that has applications that probably the drafters didn't intend. And the technically not only applies to your coffee machine, but also technically applies to the measures that link cell phones to particular carriers. And the law gives the Librarian of Congress, of all people, the authority to create exemptions to the rule every 3 years. And for the last couple of cycles, the Librarian of Congress has made an exemption for unlocking of cell phones, provided that the customer's contract had expired or that they otherwise complied with the contract by paying whatever penalty the contract called for. But in the fall of 2012, the Librarian of Congress changed positions and said that now it was so easy to get unlocked phones that there was no need for this exemption, at least as to new cell phones. And it resulted in quite the public outcry. The White House spoke out against it, the FCC, a lot of people on the Hill. There was a petition with over 114,000 signatures that was quickly signed seeking a reversal of this decision, and this bill is designed to do that. Although it would leave open the possibility that the Librarian of Congress could make a similar ruling again during the next exemption cycle, there were other competing bills that would have permanently remove this issue from the purview of the DMCA, but the bill that got through committee at least would just kick the issue down the line to the next exemption cycle. Interestingly, the bill had very strong bipartisan support until the 11th hour when a new exemption was added that would not exempt bulk unlocking of phones from the DMCA, which means that that en masse unlocking and resale of phones would still be subject to the prohibition on unlocking. It would just be unlocking by individuals that would be permitted. And that exemption to permit continued restrictions on bulk unlocking actually cost the bill a lot of supporters. Consumer groups, EFF, other members of Congress said that the bill was, you know, would just continue a misuse of copyright law to ban practices that have nothing to do with protecting copyrighted work. So it's a very odd application of copyright law.
Prospects in the Senate, any idea?
Senator Leahy has a companion bill, and I think that there's enough momentum for this among the public that there's a, to the extent anything's going to get passed, I should have that as a disclaimer, to the extent anything's going to get passed, this seems to have some chance.
All right. Well, let me ask you another kind of congressional question. The Attorney General came out in favor of a national kind of preemptive, I assume, breach notification statute. And certainly there's been a lot of business support for the idea that instead of 56 breach notification rules, we ought to have one. This strikes me as something where the administration is leaning against the plaintiff's bar, for example, where you'd expect them to look for allies, which ought to make this something that could pass. But I'm not seeing a lot of movement. What's your sense on that?
Well, I think there's when you dig behind the scenes, that this is not as much news as it was portrayed. It's been the department's position for the past few years, at least going back to 2011. That we need a federal breach notification standard to replace the 46 states and DC and Guam and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands that companies have to contend with now when they're breached. In fact, the department's cybersecurity legislative package, which the department submitted in the summer, late spring, early summer of 2011, which ultimately didn't pass, which is what led to the executive order, which we're going to talk to Adam about in a little bit. That legislative package included a proposed breach notification bill that we wrote in the Justice Department, and we worked closely with Senate Judiciary staff to try to get that bill through committee in 2011 and then again in 2012, even as a standalone vehicle, because it was the only part of the package that we thought had real legs. The problem was at the Senate side, not with the administration. I think there are a couple reasons for that. First, as I alluded to before, there's the general difficulty of getting any through this Congress in this environment, especially if it sounds like a new regulation, although as you suggested in the intro, this is a new regulation, but one that actually vastly simplifies the regulatory landscape that companies have to deal with now. I think most companies would take one rule over 50 or 46 any day of the week. You know, to wit, Senator Carper from Delaware has introduced his version of this bill three times in the last three Congresses. Senator Leahy's introduced his version of this bill, which is very closely based on our proposal when I was at DOJ, in each of the last four Congresses, and it hasn't gotten through. The second reason why I think it hasn't gotten through is because DOJ wants it. There is one member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who I will not name, who is generally opposed to anything the department wants. In fact, when we were trying to get this bill through in 2011, I used to joke that the best way to get the bill passed would be to tell him that DOJ hates it, and that would immediately get him to support it. But so I think that there is some resistance to anything the department supports. But you'd have to say that in the wake of Target and Neiman Marcus and Michaels and the degree of public attention, probably unprecedented public attention that's been paid to consumer, breaches of consumer data, it's hard to imagine more fertile, ground for getting something like this passed.
So here's my question. You may have seen this when you were there. What happened to the trial lawyers? Shouldn't they be hopping up and down and twisting Democratic arms to prevent this from happening?
Well, I think that actually should be on my list of reasons why it didn't get passed too. I don't think they were sitting silently by. I think that there were some members we would have expected to support it on the merits who didn't support it, and some of that may have been because of opposition behind the scenes by the trial lawyers, who certainly do not benefit from a simple, easy to follow. Right. Uniform breach notification.
And who have had remarkably little influence in this administration, for people who think that the administration is just selling out to traditional Democratic allies. This is not an administration that's been particularly favorably disposed toward the arguments of the trial lawyers for more liability.
Okay, Michael, we talked, we were going to talk briefly, I thought, about Julie Brill's, she's the FTC commissioner who is, you know, one of the better commissioners and one of the more thoughtful ones who's trying to struggle with the problem of what to do about big data. She's got some ideas. Did you take a look at that speech? Do you have any sense of whether she's onto something that will likely spur action?
No, I mean, I did take a look at it. I don't think it's likely to amount to much. Essentially, she, in the speech at Princeton, said that companies should voluntarily de-identify their customers' data, which, you know, I don't think is likely to go very, very far. If companies have an economic interest in knowing the identities of their customers when they're mining their data, they're going to do so unless it's illegal. And then she also endorsed a pending bill in Congress that would require data brokers to make sure that they don't engage in fraud in collecting identifiable information and also provide a mechanism to ensure that the data they have is accurate, which seems like a pretty mild form of regulation for data brokers. So I didn't see her speech as laying down a very
Yeah, the problem with de-identification is that once, if you commit to it, it's a goalpost moving exercise because the re-identification industry is advancing by leaps and bounds, and it gets easier and easier with a few bits of information to re-identify people. And so if you commit to de-identifying them in ways that cannot be re-identified, you're basically committing to destroying the data's value for almost any purpose, I suspect. All right. We're about to move to our interview, but I thought I'd give like a 2-minute review. I spent the last week at RSA, mostly meeting friends and talking in the lobby, but two things I thought were interesting. There was briefly a parallel conference of people who don't like RSA because of the stories suggesting that they took money to accept a default algorithm that cryptographers find highly suspect, called TrustyCon. It attracted some hundreds of attendees, but it had, as far as I could tell, no impact on RSA. The head of RSA said that they had more cancellations of speakers based on snowstorms in earlier years than based on the alleged boycott this year, and it was certainly it took over the entire city. It was a remarkable event. In terms of emerging topics, I thought two things were striking. There's always a kind of hot set of ideas at RSA. One of them, we're seeing this in startups, is new ways of identifying and foiling bots. As bots get used for everything from increasing your Twitter followers to click fraud for advertisements to breaking into financial accounts en masse, people have begun to take bots much more seriously than they originally did. And so you've got a lot of new thinking about how can we identify these bots from their behavior, from their characteristics and the like. And there are several startups that are pretty hot that are trying to do that, Shape Security, White Ops, and others. And the other topic that I heard a lot about and resonated to was intelligence-driven security, the idea that knowing something about who's attacking us will enable our us to come up with better security measures. That is for sure true, and it has actually quite profound implications for security in the long run. We might explore that a little when we sit down with Adam Sedgwick, because it's different from the NIST approach to security, maybe not inconsistent, but pretty different. Those are the two themes that I heard coming out of our essay, in addition to a lot of the usual of all the security companies that took money or ideas or did business with NSA saying that that doesn't mean they like them. I think everybody felt obliged to say that once during their presentations. My guess is by next year, this time when they have the next conference, it will be on to some other scandal. So that's the report from RSA. Jason, Michael, anything else you want to talk about?
You know, we did have that very interesting Ninth Circuit decision.
Oh, God, yes. Talk about this week in weird copyright. It means that fighting over whether your cell phone is a copyright issue is by no means the most unusual development.
No, this was a really interesting one. And you know, whatever you think of Judge Kaczynski's opinions, like Scalia's, they're always really fun to read. So in this case, an actress named Cindy Lee Garcia had agreed to appear in a very low-budget movie that was called Desert Warrior, which she thought was going to be a fantasy story set in Arabia. Turned out she was lied to, and her performance was put into a 14-minute film called Innocence of Muslims, which was an anti-Islamic screed. And she was given dubbed lines, including the line that says, "Is your Muhammad a child molester?" Well, not surprisingly, this set off protests around the world. She was the subject of a fatwa, received death threats. And so as a result, she filed 8 takedown notices under the DMCA with Google, and Google refused to take the video down, citing the First Amendment and other defenses. She sought a preliminary injunction. The injunction was denied by the district court, but the Ninth Circuit reversed and found that she was entitled to an injunction. There were a couple of interesting issues. The first issue that the Ninth Circuit decided was that an individual who makes a contribution to a joint work, such as a film, can still retain an independent copyright interest in her performance, which I think is apparently a very rarely litigated question, but if the Ninth Circuit decision stands, this could actually have pretty profound implications for Hollywood. My favorite passage on that point is this, in which Kaczynski is explaining why an actor retains an independent copyrightable interest. He says, "An actor does far more than speak words on a page. He must live his part inwardly and then give to his experience an external embodiment." That's quoting Stanislavski, the great acting teacher. Otherwise, every schmuck is an actor because everyone knows how to read. So much for acting. The other interesting part was he said this was not a work for hire because Garcia was not an employee. She was essentially an independent contractor. And then also that she had not given an implied license to the producer of the film to use her image in the way he did because the end result was so radically different from what she had agreed to and what she thought she was getting into. And finally, the court held that she was entitled to an injunction because obviously she was subject to death threats, and that was most obvious sort of irreparable harm. My takeaway on this is that if we ever get the animal rights groups together with the plaintiff's bar in the copyright field, you're going to have cats asserting independently copyrightable interests in YouTube videos in which they're featured. That
would be the end of the internet as we know it, because without cat logs, we're lost. Okay, so here's the quiz for the two of you guys. Extra credit for connecting that story to Hillary Clinton and Justice Brandeis. All right. Okay. I will do it. The Innocence of Muslims is the video that Hillary Clinton blamed for the Benghazi attacks in her early statements on this, and that has resulted in great angst on the Republican side, since they believed that that story was made up to save the president's bacon in the campaign. And
although it turns out to be accurate, I will say in the most recent analysis.
Well, yeah, no, we'll when we do This Week in Benghazi, we can go through that. But the other claim, if she had just a little stronger claim under California state law for the right of publicity, she would be arguing essentially that I have the right to control images of myself under state law, a state law that was passed in response to Brandeis's articles and lobbying about the right to privacy, because what he was most upset about was that people could take his picture without his permission and publish it in the newspaper. And he persuaded a number of legislatures to pass laws making that illegal without permission, and that has evolved into the idea that you can't use people's images without their permission. All right, so we've connected Brandeis and Hillary Clinton to the weirdest copyright case of the year, and I think that's it. So let's move on to our special guest. Adam Sedgwick is an old friend and somebody who's been involved in cybersecurity issues for years now, and played a major role in the release of the cybersecurity framework that the president ordered up a year ago. And first, I guess I should point out that this is a government project that came in on time and, as far as anybody can tell, under budget, despite snowstorm after snowstorm and a government shutdown. How did you do it?
I think leveraging public-private partnerships is a helpful tool in terms of spreading out the resources. So, and this sees this all the time in the work it does in standards bodies overall and the approach that we take in the federal government to rely on those international standards. So we were lucky to have a thoughtful team at NIST, people who have worked in a lot of these areas for years. And then, you know, taking a page off of a lot of other projects we've done, if it's large projects around cloud computing, or one example that we go back to a lot is the smart grid work. It was really figuring out ways to engage the stakeholders so they do a lot of the work, because really the idea of the framework was for NIST to serve as conveners and drive the conversations and do the analysis, but to have a document that could really reflect the views of the owners and operators that have to manage their own risk, and then the other parts of the ecosystem that have to assist them.
You had like four or five open meetings, and well, I wouldn't describe what you produced as a wiki. It was close. You produced a lot of drafts and let people read them and comment on them and suggest tech changes, a lot of which you adopted. You think that actually move things forward as opposed to holding it up?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we had to go back and look at various models that were used before. Often to get private sector engagement, we set up industry steering groups. That's what we did with, or are doing with NSTIC, the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, and with Smart Grid. But they actually had a little more time and more resources. So instead we took this very open-ended approach, where we sat down and mapped it out and realized the best way to do this would be to have an open and iterative process. So we have the open workshops, but leading up to the workshops, we would say, okay, here's what you should look at going into the workshops. At the workshop, we would say, on the first day, we'd say that these are our expectations today. Then we would break the groups down into working groups with the strongest facilitators that we could find. We would come back and even at the workshops do the analysis, and even by Friday, so it was typically Wednesday to Friday, we would say, okay, remember what we said on Wednesday? Here's where it appears that we were mistaken, and here's our expectation now. And then when we would come back, we would present that analysis so that the broader community, the folks that could watch this, certainly the plenaries on the webcast, could say, we think you did get the, we think you did hear what the stakeholders were saying were right, or they would say, no, you're a little off base. So, I mean, even the document itself, we did the analysis of the initial comments that we received from our broad request for information. We presented out a draft outline that looks very much like a draft. Mm-hmm. There was no mistaking. There were big gaps. We validated the draft and the outline, and then we began filling it in at our third workshop, which was kind of a key one. The folks that went at 4 out of 5 and missed that kind of regretted it. And then, you know, we had a couple different versions because it was at the workshop, so we consolidated them all together, and then we presented a discussion draft back in August, a full version. We took that for our workshop, and then we had another one in November during the last open comment period, to help us kind of make sure that, to help industry really understand what their partners were saying, and to help kind of consolidate the comments down so we could have a common, so that kind of made our lives easier when people would point at someone else and say, I like what that other guy said.
Yeah, so this shows that that Woody Allen may not have been right about much, but he was right about the standards process. 90% or more is showing up, and working. You know, if you're not there, if you miss the working group 3, you're going to regret it for a long time. Well, let's talk about the product. It falls into 3 categories. Right, you've got the core, mm-hmm. you've got the profiles, and you've got the tiers. So I'm going to give you an elaborate analogy, and you can tell me where it's wrong, because I'm trying to help people understand what this is. I think of this as a lot like a university which offers a whole bunch of courses to people, they're spread over 5 different core disciplines, and they want you to take something from each of them, but you can go in and say, I want to take advanced courses, the following courses, and these are the courses that are most important to me. I'm going to major in a particular area, just like a company can go into your core, and say, okay, you've got 5 different categories. I think the most important for people in my situation are these 2, and the others I'm going to just take a smattering of. So those are the profiles, and then the tiers are basically the grades you get in the courses. You can do well or you can do badly. I've forgotten now what the lowest grade in tier 1 is, something like getting there, words to that effect. Yeah. And the best grade you can get is adaptive. And if I understand this right, people using the standard can say, okay, so these are the things I wanted focus on, and this is the grade I want to get. This is the grade I give myself now, and this is the grade I aspire to get and that I'm working toward. Is that a fair, if kind of crude, analogy for what you did?
I would think that it's fair for 2 out of the 3. I don't think it's quite as fair for the tiers. And I actually like the analogy overall because, right, you would look at the standards that are within, you would think about something that was pretty holistic for you, for all of your interests. And then I think, you know, taking that analogy further, there might be a test at the end of the day, or you might be seeking a right. job. So you probably have the interest in doing it as best as possible.
Okay.
Right. I don't think the tiers are exactly right, because the tiers aren't really meant to be a measure of goodness. The tiers might be sort of thinking back to the college analogy that maybe, you know, you're thinking about what job or what test you want to take at the end of the process. So how you would think about the coursework would look very different.
But if I remember that the tiers say, you know, at one level, you're completely reactive. All of your programs are ad hoc. You know how to spell security, but you don't have a plan. And then it sort of moves up the tiers toward, having goals but not having a complete strategy, to having a strategy, to having something where you react immediately to new developments and
that's
you're
right.
very adaptive.
Yeah, I think that is right. I mean, I think very few people will seek to achieve to be tier 1 because right. tier 1 is getting started. But I think if you are just getting started, then doing something is better than doing nothing.
Yeah.
And so it's a step in the right direction. I think most people will seek to be tiers 2 and 3, where you do have a process. The process is informed by what happens. Tier 4, we intentionally made it to be sort of a stretch goal, because in a lot of ways, the technology that will support tier 4 might not be there. And we say that it should be cost effective, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be cost effective for a small water utility in Kansas to invest the same level of resources that Goldman Sachs does in right. terms of thinking of future technologies. And in a lot of these ways, you might not even be able to achieve tier 4 because you're relying on other parts of the ecosystem, and so
ecosystem will just not support it.
Right.
You know, your,
the technology
your
isn't there.
Control supplier right. just has said, yeah, that's a forever day defect. I'm never going
to
fix that.
Or you'd have to completely untake all of your existing ICS infrastructure and replace it with something completely new if you're seeking to be tier
right.
4. So it also, I mean, I think it helps us maintain that, you know, this isn't about a checklist. It's really about sort of how you think about cybersecurity and how you really integrate it into your business decisions. And there's been some interesting things that have come out recently. There was a World Economic Forum report that they did with McKinsey that, you know, the results were fairly sobering in terms of how even the Fortune 100 companies are able to really fully integrate cybersecurity risk management into their daily business lives. And, you know, there's probably been studies like that for the last 10 or 15 years, but that's the most recent one.
Yeah, no, it's getting worse, to be candid, because we're putting more and more stuff into the internet, getting some benefits immediately and then discovering the cost only later.
Right. And I think, but you do think there has been a focus for sort of the business leaders and making sure it's something that the boards can understand and CEOs can understand. That, again, is something that came up very organically in our process, right? Because certainly they always say, talk to the CEO. Everyone wants to talk to the CEO,
exactly.
The board. And we said, well, we got to see what the stakeholders want. And the stakeholders very early on told us, we got a lot of great risk management frameworks. We have a lot of good standards. Where you could help us is where do we translate what we're doing from the bits and bytes level to the larger decisions that need to be made throughout an organization.
And that's why there's so many tiers, can't call them tiers, there are so many subcategories in the core that, you know, you've got 5 basic ideas
right.
that you're supposed to, that everything falls into, and then under that there's categories of more specific activity and subcategories. So there's probably, 100, 120?
Yeah, around 90s. I think.
Okay, 92 subcategories,
right.
And then under that, actually, ironically, it kind of comes back and consolidates into what, probably 5 or 6 standards that you can choose from to implement those 92.
Yeah, but you can. But again, those 92 are not intended to be a checklist,
right.
Nor are those 5. I mean, we chose the word informative reference very carefully. It's supposed to. Those were something that, again, were identified by the stakeholders. If the focus initially was on things that are truly cross-sector, we asked these questions about what we were using. We actually even put out something in July called the Compendium. I don't know where we got half these names, but it was called the Compendium, and that was actually mapping all of the different standards and guidelines that were submitted. Without putting a value judgment on it.
Right, just saying this is what they're trying to do.
This is what people are using throughout.
Right.
So my hope is that we will have some mappings where people say, okay, we don't use those 5, we have these sector specific standards. Here's what our mapping looks like. And you could do that for the various sectors. And even in the informative, even in the subcategories, this sounds counterintuitive, but what I would love people to do is create their own profile, right, a standardized profile, and say, we use some of the 92, but here are some other ones that aren't supported by informative references, but are specific to our company, and we think help us achieve the outcomes in the categories and in the functions better than what's there.
Yeah, I can see how somebody who's very well informed about security could end up doing that.
And I want them to do, I mean, my hope is that people do that early, because otherwise I think companies will just go and say, okay, here are the 92 things I have to do.
You can
and
say
it might be inevitable.
You can say it's not
right.
a checklist, but it's going to get used that way, I think, because it's not a terrible list of things that you ought to think about if you're designing or reviewing your security program. It is a list of things that people ought to think about at that level. Now, you would hope that they would go from thinking about it and checking off the box to actually saying, what's the best way to achieve this overall goal in my industry for my company, rather than, can I find something that checks this box?
Yeah, and I think part of the focus on outcomes was so that people understand that they should be looking for those more advanced capabilities, right? And the capabilities are going to change, right? So that's what helps us get some of the flexibility. Right now, so to do asset management right now, that alone is a huge problem. It's so fundamental. But, you know, my colleagues at NIST, some of the best we have are the ones that look at, that are working with the IETF and other standards bodies so that SCAP, which is the language to enable computer-to-computer discussion, is in IETF and then is more supported even more by commercial off-the-shelf products.
Right. I can imagine somebody saying, yeah, you told me to identify my assets. I am never going to identify all my assets. Somebody is always walking in with an iPhone and connecting to our system. And I can't expect to do a census and control that. Instead, I've got a set of rules about what an iPhone that connects to my system can do, and I'd rather just say, you know, bring in anything you want, but you can only do this with it.
And that's precisely what we see on the federal side with mobile device management, right? Because that's basically right. What that is. But we also think that if the capabilities are supported in the underlying products, commercial off-the-shelf products, then for any of these things, when we see improvements in that, it makes the lives of the critical infrastructure owners and operators and even the broader ecosystem a lot easier. Yeah. So now with this, I mean, one of the things I think we do next is work with the IT and ICS service providers to talk about how they support the capabilities found in the framework.
So you pretty deliberately called this framework 1.0.
Mm-hmm.
That implies that there's going to be a 1.1 or a 2.0. What's the roadmap ahead?
Well, I think 1.1 would be for errata, and one of the things we're probably well, most happy.
Surely
about,
would
yeah,
be that.
Most of the things. One of the things I'm most happy about is that no one at least has identified anything that made me think we need to do that.
You mean
yet.
You jammed this out under that deadline, and there are no typos?
So far, no one's identified one, or maybe they're just being nice because they know how hard we worked. So I think what we'll do with 2.0, again, we think the approach is pretty flexible as it stands. In some ways, there should be a level that's already dynamic. We'll work with DHS, you know, setting up this voluntary program with their relationship with the sectors. And they have more of the operational information as they grow their watch center through the NCIC. We are kind of, you know, embarking on a lot of regional visits. We're partnering with the Manufacturing Extensionship Partnership, so that they're in all 50 states, that NIST helps. So traveling around, realizing that we need to broaden the base of stakeholders, that there are not a lot of – we had great engagement, and we had a lot of people representing those companies, but not a lot of the owners and operators are not going to have the time to come to a NIST workshop and make the response. So we'll go out and do some outreach with them to continue to understand their needs. And then what we intend to do is at some point, when the time is right, when we've learned enough about how people are using this, then we'll restart the process and we'll restart the workshops and we'll ask people a similar set of questions about what needs to change in this document overall. And while we're doing that, I think a key topic of conversation will be, how do we do a tech transfer? So how do we move this so the framework itself rests within the private sector, and what the government will do will kind of further support industry's use of this.
So I think that's going to be very interesting because it ties into and may conflict with the other thing that the president said he wanted, which was he wanted all of the regulatory agencies to figure out whether they could adopt this under their existing authorities. He wanted DHS to find a variety, and the Treasury Department and Commerce to come up with incentives for people to adopt this because he thought it would improve security, which means he thought it would change behavior. Many of these regulatory agencies would be surprised to discover that they might impose this requirement, and then that industry would say, well, you can impose a requirement, but we're going to rewrite it, until it meets our inclinations rather than the regulators. How do you see that tension playing out?
So we had a similar tension play out with the smart grid, right? Mm-hmm. That did involve some regulators. And what we did with the regulators is we approached their interests in a couple different ways. One was, we asked our stakeholders to identify, the regulatory requirements that exist today. We didn't want to create a framework that couldn't be taken up and used because it would run into uh-huh. conflict. We asked the regulators to come and participate in our workshops. We asked them to submit comments both early on and with the RFI, but also for the preliminary framework. And certain regulators came to all of our workshops. The FCC in particular, we actually put on the stage to talk about how they their initial considerations about how they would leverage the framework. And I think the work that the regulators are doing now, and I think the work we'll do with industry, is understanding how those requirements can fit into the common taxonomy and language of the framework. And some of that's already happening.
They could use this not so much as a checklist, but as a way of explaining to industry what they expect. They could say, we expect you to be Tier 2 on at least these parts of the standard, and that's just their way of explaining it. You could later change the standard, but it would not eliminate the fact that a particular regulatory agency had set Tier 2 as the expectation, and that wouldn't be changed even if the standard evolved.
I think that's right, and I think the regulators would be involved in any of the updates that happen.
Because it would have to be by consensus, is that your thinking?
That's part of it.
Consensus would mean that the regulators could say, no consensus here, and it wouldn't change?
Well, I think it's a good conversation. I mean, what we're going to do is corral all these people when we have these workshops, including the regulators, and understanding all those considerations. Because it's going to have to be a unique model, right? Because smart grid only involved one regulator. Right.
And I have to say, I've read some of the security rules that came out for the energy industry out of the NIST process, and they're not very demanding, right? I think the most concrete one was that passwords ought to be at least 6 digits long.
I don't know if I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, this is the one that was adopted by NERC, and FERC.
We presented that as a model, but I don't think they've adopted anything just yet. I think they're working on it. But what's interesting is also I think regulators are also looking at sort of the downstream risks that are introduced. Mm-hmm. So they're asking their regulated sectors. So you can look at both OCC, Office of the Control of the Currency, and CFPB.
Oh yes,
they both have issued some regulations about considering. Kind of the services that you rely upon.
Right.
So I think in some ways this helps this sort of standardized way of expressing how you're managing risk kind of helps everyone, including
the
regulators.
I think that's right. I mean, a lot of the rules under for the financial industry under Gramm-Leach-Bliley are sort of paint the Golden Gate Bridge rules, where you start at one end, you identify, you evaluate the cure, and you're back to identifying the problem, and you just keep doing that constantly.
That's right, and I think,
which is very similar to what the standard.
Yeah, and I think they leverage COBIT quite a bit, which is one of the five standards we map to.
So this does allow the inspectors that are sent out by the regulatory agencies to ask questions and expect answers that are literate in the terminology in your standard. That's valuable.
And let's not forget, I mean, it's more than just the federal regulators, right? You have the state regulators.
Right.
You have international regulators. So if we can help streamline that fracturing and the difficulties so that you can do what you have to do and then express it multiple ways for multiple authorities. I mean, I think that's a real value that this process can allow that's hard to argue with.
So I, do you expect to see the emergence of a kind of mini industry of people who will say, I will translate your existing security practices and strategy into the framework and tell you where you may need to make changes in order to look, appropriate under the standard? Because, you know, I'm sure it's going to be adopted by, regulators, and in any event, it's going to be a feature of negligence cases in the future, because the courts are going to say, look, this is a government standard. If you didn't follow it, then we're going to assume you were negligent. So people will want to be able to say, no, I had somebody in and he looked at it and he told me I was following the standard except in these three areas, so I made changes.
So I think I would answer that question by kind of bifurcating it a little bit. On the first end, in terms of looking at how those existing standards fit in, that certainly is happening, right? Mm-hmm. And that kind of happens anytime there's a new NIST standard or a new ISO standard or a new critical controls, where there's this huge mapping effort that everyone does. And there are tools that RSA has with Archer. IBM announced a tool as well, specifically to the framework. So I think that piece will absolutely happen, where people, and I think that's going to happen with a lot more now, because people are going to say, okay, the framework says I can build off my existing security program. This is what I'm doing now. What other tools can I use based on the framework to help me improve?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's very natural. I think early on, that's something that we can assist with. And we even have a statutory role to assist with that. On your second piece, I would actually think about that in two different ways. One is the conformity assessment piece. And that, you know, that's NIST-ology for, or standardology for, how do you actually show that you're adhering to the standards?
Right.
And so some of that already exists, even with the underlying standards, if you look at 27001 and also ISO 62443, which is really specific to ICS. So some of that we can leverage,
right.
And I think we'll have those conversations that's addressed in our roadmap.
So people who are already doing conformity assessment for those standards have really very little work to do to also say, yes, you are in conformity with the standard framework.
I think we'll have those conversations,
okay.
Yeah. And then I think, you know, in terms of negligence, I think, you know, again, the framework is organically not one size fits all. So if it helps people build strong security programs that are defensible, then I think that's great. But I think just following some of the discussion, and there seems to be some level of disagreement from the legal community, a lot of folks say that it not being one size fits all wouldn't lend itself to that.
Right.
But maybe you'd see something where...
It just means it's easier to do. It's you can have your own interpretation, and you can say, really, all I need is a B-. In this area.
Well, yeah, and I think the rigor to which you made those processes will have to be ones that you can defend,
yeah.
And how you made those risk decisions. I mean, I think one of the things I like about the framework is that I think by having those five functions, it's interesting if you see the mappings, right?
Right.
And see where the various standards are. We got a ton on identify, a ton on protect, a fair amount on detect, respond and recover. There are only a handful there.
That's a little scary.
It is, and when we talk about what's going on, so it still has that presumption that we can stop them at our gates, right?
Yeah,
and
which we've
heard at RSA,
false.
Yeah, it hasn't been true for a very long time. And so I think making sure that people, I think we need a slight, this is me personally speaking, we need a slight cultural change there, so that we think about the quality of the security program and realizing that incidents are going to happen.
And I won't dwell on this because we should be wrapping up, but I do think that because the standard is still a sort of techie focus on the things we ought to be doing as opposed to who's attacking us and why, what do they want to do and what tools are they using. And to my mind, if you really want to be adaptive, you need to know at all times, and you have to have constant intelligence about the changing threat environment, what the People's Liberation Army is doing, looking for who they're attacking, how they're attacking people successfully. And once you know, you know, whose bullseye you're in, that tells you a lot about the tools you need to keep them out. And you've got to constantly upgrade that. And to my mind, that's a more effective way to think about this than, you know, what you know, how do I fit into this particular profile?
But I think that might be true again for the complex multinational Goldman Sachs type corporation that can hire
you could be a 501c3 sponsored this speaking out for Tibetan human rights, and you're going to face a very serious threat. You may decide, look, we're just going to let them in because we can't keep them out. But you really, at that point, you wonder, well, why would you bother to have any real security if you know they're in?
I think
so. The little guys, sometimes the little guys have the most sophisticated opponents. And you're kidding yourself if you say, I'm a little guy, I can't afford this, so I'll buy as much security as I can afford.
No, I think
that won't work.
No, but I think we can work on the mechanisms to strengthen the ability to receive that information, right? So some of the standardized way of communicating this that we're seeing in FSISAC.
Right? Okay.
So we certainly realize that people have to identify those things.
Right.
But it would be difficult for us to suggest that they need to hire a team to go out and investigate as is. Right?
I take your point, and the government probably could do more than they have done to give that.
Yeah, and I think that's the other piece of the executive order, right? The other piece of the executive order was on information sharing, and improving the capabilities from DHS to share that. What this is focused on is, okay, you have that information. How do you build strong security programs around that? And there is a limited set of things that you'll do, real understanding what the threat looks like. So even that, I think you would still use the framework. The only change you might recommend is building out capability to get the threat in under identify. And it sounds like you also might have some concerns about how we express external participation within the tiers, where we say if you're a larger part of the critical infrastructure, you probably have you really need to, you know, gather information but also share it out. Because you play that bigger role and you'll have a bigger understanding of what's going on.
No, I think they should do that for sure. But, let me close this off by giving you a compliment and a complaint and then giving you the last word to respond to, either or both of them. The compliment, you guys started out with something on privacy that I thought was a disaster. It was going to raise the cost of security. You know, usually government agencies lock into the last thing that they proposed because it was the only thing that they could satisfy all the stakeholders with. To your credit, you completely rewrote the privacy approach to make it much more flexible and to give a lot more leeway to companies to incorporate reasonable considerations of privacy into their security as opposed to meeting some abstract and specific maximization requirements. So that's the compliment. Here's the complaint. I mentioned that you had you did this through the government shutdown. I went to your site to look at the framework in draft during the government shutdown, and NIST, not alone among federal agencies, but certainly wasn't this wasn't uniform practice, had turned off its entire internet website so that nobody could actually get the documents during the government shutdown. I had to get them from Lawfare. Could there be anything more Bush League than that? Could you have saved 20 cents by shutting off your server? It would probably cost you more to turn your server off than to leave it on. So this is your opportunity to apologize to everybody who went to your website and met that bizarre 404 message. So you can respond to the complaint or to the compliment as you choose.
I'll start with the complaint and I will apologize. Wasn't my decision to make, but I think, you know, again, people looked at the law, looked at what they were able to do, and then they made different decisions. But you are not alone in that criticism. And certainly others expressed that they would have liked the ability to leverage all of those, not just the framework, but the other suite of standards and guidelines that we present at csrc.nist.gov, which are used throughout industry. On the privacy piece, I will take the compliment. I would say it was a good test of our process, right? Because you know, we didn't rewrite the privacy section. Really, the stakeholders did. So I think, you know, we had a couple, we always had a challenge to figure out how to address the methodology for privacy and civil liberties that was called for in the executive order. But more significantly than that, the stakeholders said, when you consider how to grow a good security program, think about privacy and civil liberties as well. The problem was they didn't really give us the breadcrumbs in terms of how to best do that. So we presented a variety of options, and then the stakeholders, a lot of the stakeholders said what you said, which it really needs to be tied more closely to the security program because this wasn't intended to be a freestanding set of principles for consumer privacy. Those things are out there. There are other initiatives. It really should be tied more closely into what organizations need to consider when they're growing cybersecurity programs and what the potential risks are there with privacy and civil liberties. And that's actually an area where the shutdown actually helped in terms of timing, right? Because it gave, it gave Harriet Pearson the ability to bring her stakeholders together, come out with the alternative methodology. It gave us ability to present at the workshop, and it was our first, our first panel after the NIST panel that we always sort of started out with. It was our first external panel. Which was really a good one. I recommend it's still up, I believe, at North Carolina. But to have, you know, ACLU, MITRE, you know, Harriet, the White House, and NIST and Intel Corporation present their views so that the stakeholders could weigh in and tell us back, what they wanted. And, you know, there was a lot of support, for Harriet's methodology, but also to pull in, some of the other aspects so people understand what those things they should be looking for when they're growing a cybersecurity program. So, thanks.
Well,
for
this goes to show.
Oh, and I will say, April 9th and 10th, we're actually having a workshop on privacy at NIST and privacy engineering. So we'll further the conversation.
All right. Well, remember Woody Allen. You know, better show up. That has been Adam Sedgwick with a great discussion of the new cybersecurity framework coming out of NIST. And that is the end of Episode 9 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vattis, Jason Weinstein, and especially Adam Sedgwick. We hope you'll join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. For more information, please visit our website at www.steptoecyberblog.com. Thank you.